Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
But I wanted to sit on the head in the bed and say, Dad, I hope I've made your prayer. Sorry, it's emotional. I hope I've made your prayer out of my life. And I didn't get to say it.
This week on Grief Encounters, Venetia and I are joined by the wonderful Brent Pope. You guys know him, obviously, from all his amazing work in the rugby world. But we spoke to him about losing his dad, Mick. And it's such a beautiful conversation and a real eye-opening conversation around how men deal with grief. And to me, it's a real love story of a father and son and how much they shared. I want to thank Brent for joining us and for being so generous with his story. And I think a lot of people will gain a lot from this chat.
Our guest this week is the New Zealand rugby journalist, charity worker and children's book author Brent Pope. He originally moved to Ireland for 3 months and has stayed 30 years, I think, at this stage. There's a huge symbiosis between grief and mental health. And in recent years, Brent has done some stellar work in speaking about his troubles with depression and anxiety. Now, last April, Brent's father sadly passed away, and he's here to tell us about his beautiful relationship with him and, of course, minding your mental health after loss. And I think the mental health and loss, you couldn't be more right when you say they go hand in hand.
Yeah.
How has that been for you? How's that?
Well, there's been a lot. It's the word that resonates with me the most is loss.
Yeah.
Because I always found not much of it is in between love and loss. You know, there's not a lot of difference between them. There's a thin line between the two of them. And when you've experienced that sort of in your life, they're very, you know, there's a direct sort of parallel to healthy mental health in that sense, you know, because how people deal with grief, how people deal with loss, whether it's the loss of a relationship, the loss of a marriage, the loss of finances, the loss of a loved one, it's how we deal with that. And I haven't always found that easy, coming from an anxiety-driven background, bouts of depression, then that has been extremely difficult for me to overcome those periods of loss in my life, whatever it is. And I mean, especially last year, given the relationship I had with my father and given the regret and given the thoughts of having not really seen their life for the last 30 years, nor have they seen mine. And we were just talking about it before. It was pre-Facebook days, pre-Skype days, days we used to keep in contact just by a letter or the odd phone call. But there's a lot of regret when you lose someone. You think, oh, you know, I wish I'd done things differently. I wish I'd had a different life to some regards. Now, I know both my parents, and actually I'm going to have to go through that again. I'm just back from New Zealand, sort of caring for my mother, who's gone downhill pretty rapidly since the death of my father, which is not unusual for couples that have spent so long together. Their loneliness comes to play into play, and that can be, you know, really destructive at an older age. So I'm going to have to go through that dreaded phone call again at some stage. And when I heard about my father's passing, it was kind of, I was away enjoying a couple of days off in Portugal. I got a missed call from my brother about, my father had been into a home about a year before and was suffering from Parkinson's disease. And I knew I was going to get that phone call at some stage. And I just visited him a few months previous, this time last year. And I kind of hoped, you know, I thought, oh, you know, Dad, you know, we'll get another you know, we'll get another 5 years, you know, somewhat maybe selfishly thinking that, because it wouldn't have been a particularly pleasant experience for him or the family for those 5 years. But I thought, look, and then to get a call, a missed call from my brother, and then to ring the kind of hospital or whatever, and for the young nurse to say, look, you know, your father's gone. And I was just devastated.
And you never feel further away.
Yeah. And then I've got to had to go through all this ritual of trying to book flights, trying to get back for the funeral, because New Zealand's not like Ireland in a sense that, you know, they've got to get going with funeral arrangements. And, you know, and someone said something strange to me. Oh, you know, we'd understand if you can't get back. And I thought, oh my God, you don't realise. You know,
People do say the funniest, weirdest things.
You know, you don't realise what the relationship was with Dad and I, to know that I would do everything to get back and to play my part in the eulogy and to be there or whatever. You know, look, I just had to do it. But it was a long way back. And I remember just sitting numb in the plane for 35 hours or something. It was a lovely Australian woman on the plane saw me crying kind of in the middle of the night, and she just said, what's wrong, and I explained that I was going home to my funeral, and it was, and she was lovely to me.
Isn't it wonderful that she had the courage to ask, because sometimes people just are too scared,
especially when you're a bigger guy like me and you're sitting there sort of just with your head just sobbing. I didn't sleep, you know, it was anything like that. It was very emotional when I, you know, and I know now I'm going to have to go through that journey again when mum goes, you know.
Can you tell us a little bit about your dad? Because you have talked about his generosity and the fact, I think you said that he's always helped people, but never for personal gain.
Never for personal gain. I'd like to think that that has rubbed off on me. Also, the I suppose, you know, Dad was a very anxious man and had suffered from his own, I suppose, mental health issues, so I've inherited some of that, because he was always a worrier. But what I like to think I've inherited is a kind, giving back nature, which he ever was, you know. And I remember even talking at the funeral about memories of my dad helping people. He's very well respected, and he got both my parents actually have got Queen's medals based on work they've done in society. Dad for, I suppose, being well respected, it'd be on a lot of boards around town. You know, I used to say they were like the Kennedys, and we come from a small rural town. Like, Dad was president of the golf club, Mum was president of the racing club. But Dad was on a lot of boards, hospital board.
They were involved.
Involved, yeah. Heavily involved. But the one thing that meant the most to me was he was involved with an access trust that gave people a chance in life, gave them a chance to get a job or whatever, or get their life back on order. And I remember being in Christchurch Square one time, and I dropped my wallet, and when as I reached down for it, a big boot, a big what they call hobnail boots in New Zealand, which were big boots sort of with a steel cap toe, sort of stood right by the wallet. And I looked up, and there was a kind of a gang member, which a fearsome tattooed Māori gang member of either the Black Power or Mongol Mob, one of these big gangs, and heavily tattooed on the face. And I was just petrified. I thought, you know, and he looked down at me, he said, you look like Mick Pope or something, which is my father's name. And I said, yes. I said, I'm his son. And he put out his hand, and I remember being like covered in tattoos or whatever, and he said, hey, bro, or something. He gave me a chance in life no one else did. And nearly brings me to tears now telling that story, because he introduced me to his two kids then. He said, you know what? He said, I'm on the straight and narrow. He said, I haven't been involved in anything. He said, when everybody else turned me away, your father just said to me, look, if you can keep your nose clean in this job, he said, you'll do well. And he said, I've brought up a family. He said, you know, he said, I've got off crime and I've got off drugs and all that. And I thought, that was my dad to a T. And he would do it without wanting anything or wanting praise. He shunned, even when he got his Queen's Order medal, he didn't want to go up and get it. He just said, look, he said, there's other people deserve it more than me. And it was, we had to prompt them to say, look, but he never enjoyed that side of it. He was a quiet man. But our relationship was strong, because I always said, I don't come from a silver spoon background. My father had to work 3 or 4 jobs. And that made him proud of me. He didn't have to do that, because he married my mother and she was from a wealthy family. But my father never wanted to take any of that money, if that makes sense. He always said, look, I'll make my own way in life. He was proud. And I used to spend days, you know, he used to be a contract cleaner. He would go to work in the morning, and then after work he would go out cleaning buildings or washing windows or cleaning chimneys or anything like that. Mm. And while I was, I'd say I was a little bit ashamed at school to think that your father was a chimney sweep or something, was embarrassing for me for a while. And then I just thought, no, damn it. You know, he's a man that's trying to put food on the table any way he can. And that's what I loved about him. I loved the fact that, you know, the easiest thing would have been to do would have been to take the easy money and something. He said, no, I'll make my own way in life.
And that must make you very proud now.
Yeah, really proud. Because I'd like to think I've inherited that as well. You know, I'd like to think I've inherited that fact that I've worked hard all my life like he did. And, you know, I'm not coming from a background that was spoiled, certainly far from it, you know. But also, I wrote an autobiography, and the sad thing was he rang me and I said, Dad, are you okay with everything in the book? And he said, yeah. He said, just don't make me out to be someone that was poor or whatever. And I said, no, it's not that. I said, it's actually, which was really sort of a sad moment. Yeah. I said, no, Dad. I said, it's the fact that you worked really hard and that I'm really proud of that, you know, that fact that you'd work all out. Now, it meant that I didn't see a lot of my father, in a sense, because I always remember he'd come back after work and he'd always bring a chocolate bomb, which was a little ice cream, into your room and whatever, something like that, and he'd sit with you, something like that. And memories, actually, I was a very sickly child. They thought I had leukemia for years or cancer or whatever, and I was always bedridden. I was a bad asthmatic. But the one memory that I have is waking up in the middle of the night, my father being sat on the side of the bed with a rug over him, keeping me safe. Yeah. And that's a lovely image to have of your parent. Like, I'd wake up and I'd be so sick, and I'd just look over and it'd be there, him sitting in an old chair with a rug over him, trying to get some sleep, but just being there, you know.
Isn't that such a thing about, because I think working parents often feel such a struggle of, I'm not there enough, and that's what they're going to remember, and they're going to, you know. Mm. But a lot of times, especially in retrospect, when you look back and you think of how hard they were working for you, you don't feel that way at all. And
feel the opposite.
You feel the opposite. I mean, my dad was the exact same. My dad came from nothing and he worked, ridiculously hard. And I would have seen him at the weekend. Probably wouldn't have seen him an awful lot at the weekdays, but I would see him at the weekend and we would rake leaves because he still had stuff to do around the house, but he'd include me in it. And
the same as me.
You know, but looking back now, I think of him, I think how hard that was for him, because now I'm doing it and I'm working and I'm going home. And so I see it, but it's not about the loss of time where they were off working. It's just about those special moments.
It's what you did with the time you had.
And it's lovely to say, because at times, you were probably a bit like me, at times you got fed up and thought, Dad always had work for us to do. Like, it wouldn't matter, the weekend, you'd say, come on, Brent, you know, we'll go down and we've got to clean out the rooms or something down in some law offices and polish the floors. So it was hard labour.
Cheap labour, though.
Yeah, cheap labour. And I remember we used to have, we had land and we used to, he planted all these trees, but you'd have to carry the buckets of water, like something out of a Walt Disney movie, carry the buckets of water, and the buckets got further from the stream. And I remember doing those on hot, stinking hot Sundays, and that carrying these two buckets, and that you'd lose half the water by the time you got the swing on. But special memories when you look back of sort of father and son. Even when he came over here at an advanced age, you know, he'd strap himself up to the roof and that. Like, he was a great handyman. He would always wanted to be a builder. And he went back, and I mean, he was still working. He never missed a day of work, you know, and he was still working up until his 80s. And he would come over, and what I love about my house now in Dublin is it was something that we shared together. You know, Dad and son working on their house or something, getting up, you know, we used to wash ourselves an old bucket because we were living in the house when it was being demolished and whatever like that. And I love those times. I have really fond memories.
Is that something, do you find the memories make you feel better? Do they make you smile? Or are there days when the memories are just
some
too much?
One particular memory, it's a funny story. I had a friend over from New Zealand playing rugby when I was coaching out in Clontarf, and Dad came over to, and he loved building fences. That was his thing, you know, and he would be meticulous. If he was out by 2 inches, he'd have to redo the hole. But anyway, we were sitting at time just waiting to go off to rugby training, and we could see Dad out the back digging yet another hole for a fence. And he was attacked by a bee or a wasp. And that wasn't the funny thing, but it was his reaction, because he tried to run away. away from it. And obviously the bee, like sometimes happened, followed him, right? And I could see him out there running around the backyard with this bee sort of trying. And then he went to sort of kick out at the bee or something. And he strained a muscle in a very delicate area. So that was fine. So he came in cursing and blinding or something like that. And what you did in that generation is he strapped a packet of peas up near his groin area for the sort of, you know, that was it.
Yeah.
And I could just see him on the couch with this packet of peas with a bandage around or a sock or something, keeping it in place to get the icing. Well, when we come back from training, what did he have on the tea for dinner?
Oh, no,
it was peas. And I remember this guy saying, hey, Mick, they're not the same peas that you had stuck up more or less under your underpants. Yeah, what's wrong with them? They're in a plastic bag or something. So we shunned the peas. But that was Dad, you know, like that was just him. He was just people in Ireland loved him, and he loved coming to Ireland because he was such a chatty guy, and he'd go down to the shop and he'd talk to all the girls down there or something, and they'd love Mick, you know, and they said, oh, when's Mick coming back? And I remember coming back one time from work, and there he is going up the hill with a wheelbarrow full of timber with the travellers who were having their big bonfire. And, you know, a whole line in behind Dad walking up the hill and that. And they would call around to the house, you know, for years after that and say, is Mick still here? Because, you know, there was no judgment in his life. Mm. There was no criticism. And he just said, hey, these guys are great young kids. He said, I'm going to go out and help them. They need a few fire offcuts for the fire or something like for the bonfire and that.
Yeah.
And he that was his nature.
We could all learn a lot from people like that.
Yeah. No judgment. Dad didn't, it wouldn't matter. He was quite happy talking to gang members or addicts or those people. He was a Christian man. Faith made him very non-judgmental, and I like to think I'm the same, you know, that he could talk to people. In fact, he didn't like going to events and that, you know, he might be getting awards or something. He just felt difficult around people that would.
But that's also the anxiety coming up as
well.
Yeah,
he'd be amazed. Yeah. Oh, Brent, you know, I these are not my people or something. I don't come from money or I don't come from stuff like that. But very proud. And I loved him dearly and I miss him, you know.
Mm. Just on the anxiety and grief, I suffered very badly from it. I found that very unexpected.
Yeah.
I really thought that it was going to be sadness, a manifested sadness or maybe depression. But I didn't expect not being able to sleep, panic, fear, walking down the street and being very disconnected from my brain, like feeling like I was watching myself and things like that. And I found that very frightening because I had no guidebook. I obviously saw, you know, people, we all have anxieties in different levels, but nothing
not
on
level.
That level.
No.
Did it kind of heighten for you, or had you learned tools at that point to?
Yeah, well, that's a really good point because I like the fact you used the word disconnection because that's how you feel. I'd had a life of panic attacks, whatever, so I knew that disconnection feeling, and it's hard to describe to people. It's hard to describe to people when you're kind of looking down at somebody else completely, and you're saying, you know, all these things that you put into place about shouldn't worry or, you know, what's the worst that can happen, all these tools that I have, it still doesn't take away the fear that when you're, you know, I often use the U2 song, caught in the moment and can't get out of it. And that's what it's like. And more for me was, I suppose, I really went on a bit of a spiral, you know, in a sense of kind of regret again and the loss. And it would hit me at different times because it hit me originally straight away, obviously getting that call in Portugal. I was just, I didn't know what to do. I went into the panic stage of all that sort of anxiety of not believing. You know, this can't be happening, or this hasn't happened, or there's been a mistake, or Dad hasn't gone, or I haven't had the chance to say I love him. And that's a regret, you know, like, because the Christmas before, I wrote a lovely note to my brother because I'm so appreciative of what he has done because he's back in New Zealand. And I couldn't have done the same thing he's doing, organising the funeral, all those things, you know, like even when I'm back this year, organising things with Mum. His role has been carer. So in some ways I feel guilty because I can sneak back to Ireland, if you know what I mean. But yet they would wanted me to make my life where I made them. But I went all through that, and I went through, and the one regret was I had, I was going to, when Dad was, with Parkinson's, he wasn't, the conversations weren't free-flowing as they'd be, or that he wouldn't recognise you sometimes, or he wouldn't have the memories, and that's the unfortunate thing about dementia and Parkinson, anything to do with that. But getting on the plane, I just said, you know, you didn't tell Dad you loved him and what he meant to you, but you'll do it next time. And it wasn't a next time. Mm. And, like, he knew I loved him.
Of course, yeah.
And he knew that. And he would always be very upset when I was going back, apart from the last time, because he didn't know the upset anymore. Like, he'd always take me up to the airport, and he'd always be in tears and say, I love you, son, or whatever, and, you know, I wish you were here. But he said, I understand. Mm. Until the last time, because he couldn't get the dates, or was I going back, or where I wasn't, he'd be getting me mixed up with my brother and stuff like that. It was fine. But I wanted to sit on the edge of the bed and say, Dad, I hope I've made you proud. Sorry, it's emotional. Mm-hmm. I hope I've made you proud in my life. And I didn't get to say it. So I went through all that. I went through probably more the depressive side of feeling alone, feeling loneliness, thinking I didn't give them grandchildren, I haven't been married, all those things. I was pretty hard on myself for the last maybe 6 months, and it was a hellish year last year. And, trying to put all those things together and going to see a therapist, which I had to do, to say, look, you know, don't be so hard on yourself. You know, all those emotions started coming at me full time. And then suddenly, when you just thought you're getting to terms with it, something else would come in. You'd see a movie or hear a song, and I'd go back into that place, and I'd go back, and I'd have to sit alone, and I'd be crying, sort of, and I'd just say, God, you know, Dad, I miss you and stuff, and, you know, all these things, like, you know. And I remember something as simple as people say, whether it's, I remember about two months before Dad passed away, I had a photo of him on my locker, and the photo fell off and broke.
Yeah, and those weird things that happen.
And I looked, and I know, look, but it was just kind of, you know, was that a sign? I do get increased spirituality. I do look to God and say, look, you know, I hope you're looking after Pops, you know, like it's, I do spend moments of time saying, you know, where are you, you know, are you safe, you know, are you happy, you know, all those things. So you go through a lot of emotions, you know, but the first one, I suppose, is devastation and not having your own family. It's lonely. It's acute loneliness in my life. And I look back and I say, I'm alone, you know.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
But I think even though I would describe it as if when I'm out, like I can be out with like loads of best pals or whatever, but you're just, they're there.
Yeah. No, exactly.
Even though you're physically there, you're actually over there.
Absolutely.
And that, I think that takes time to
it does,
go away.
And you say that. And when I came back here, I was exactly that. I was out with friends. We'd gone to watch, I think, one of the Leinster match. And I just had to apologise. I was talking to a couple of people, and I just broke out in tears. You know, I just something just hit me, and I just said, "Look, I'm sorry." Yeah. I said, "You know, they didn't know. You know, we're not saying they're strangers, but they didn't know. But to see this grown man sitting in front of them, just sobbing, and I said, "Look, I've got to go home." I said, "I lost my father not so long ago, and it comes in waves, and people will tell
it's
you
the
that."
Train moment.
I think that's really good that you were able to say that out loud, though, instead of making excuses, because I think when you start to play into that, then people don't have a real view of what life is like after you've gone through something. If you're able to say, and it can be a hard thing to say, like, look, this happened and I can't be here right now, But on the side of regret, I would be interested in knowing if you have found any healthy ways of dealing with it, because one, people, especially on this podcast, we've noticed like it's the hardest area to go to, because you can't change it.
No.
I have, just when you said about your dad, when you would say goodbye, I have all my emails from my mother. At the end, she says, I wish that you'd move back here. I wish that you were here. Mm. Why don't you come home?
Yeah.
And tough. I actually don't read them, because every time I read that line or that thing, there's just this shame and regret and hits you, right? You know, it does. Have you found any healthy ways to deal with regret? Do you know, like...
Yes and no. I think that the thing to realise is that what they would have wanted for you in your own life. Yeah. I don't think any parent that loves their children doesn't think, okay, you know, I just wanted them to be proud of me, proud of the life that I've made over here. Yes, regrets in the sense that, you know, like me, they haven't seen the best parts of my life.
Yeah.
Because I found a card the other day thinking about it the other day. I found a card when I was back in New Zealand I sent to Mum, signed off as the Irish Wolfhound, and it was nearly 30 years ago. And I just moved over here at the time, and I said, don't worry, you'll be seeing me soon. I'm not about to stay here. And I thought, you know, she was the same, just about the same age as I am now.
Yeah.
Mm. And that really hit home. And for that, I have regrets. But I try to reframe things. And I try to reframe things. I use a lot of that in my life and think that, okay, you know, I live a lot of my life out of inspiration for my father, if that makes sense. You know, I think what would Dad do now? Like, how would Dad look at this? How would Dad say, look, Brent, don't worry, you know, things will be okay, or, you know, be kinder to someone, or give back, and all those things. So I live a lot of my good points in my life through him.
Yeah.
And I think that's a way of kind of dedicating a memory to somebody and saying he still lives in me in that way, and that's made it a little bit easier. I do realize there's going to be waves of times, and I just say, daddy, oh, I miss you, you know. Like, there'll be times like that when I get upset, or when I'm a bit down, or whether something's gone wrong, I probably look to the heavens and say, you know, just keep an eye on me, you know, if you're there, and we'll get through this together. So there's ways of I don't know whether you deal with everybody has to find their own way. You know, like, I mean, some people are ripped apart for a long period of time. Other people can seem... What I do know is that it is unfair to judge how people look at grief. I was very grief-stricken, and I wrote about it on Facebook, and I wrote these lovely sentiments to my dad's, because that's the way that I felt. And I knew then that everybody grieves in some way. And a woman came up to me at one time. She said, Brent, that was so lovely what you said about your father. She said, but I didn't actually grieve my father until about 2 or 3 years after it. Mm. She said, I was hurt. I was angry that he had left me and all this. And she said, I couldn't grieve on the day of the funeral. And I thought that was strange. But now I get it. People grieve in different ways at different times. Yeah. And they should be allowed that.
I mean, that's one thing I think we've learned in the last year and a bit, is that everybody, there's no right or wrong.
There's no right or
and
wrong.
There's no template. And it's however you deal with it. And some days
you can be fine,
and the next day you're sitting on the kitchen floor. And
some people don't want to see it.
They
keep mementos, and they keep things, and they say, look, you know, they haven't gone away at all like that. Yeah. And that's a block of a certain kind.
Mm.
And it's only sudden. And you often get, because I went back and trained as a psychotherapist. So, you know, I remember a client coming to me about a year ago, and he just said to me, Brent, he said, I'm 60 years of age. He said, I still drive around to my mother's house and I sit outside. And he said, I've never grieved her death. And he said, I've never grieved. And that might have been 20 years on or something. And he said, I want to let go. I need to let go. But there's different stages of grief, and there's different stages of how people take it. We all know the stages, you know, that are written in books, but that doesn't often... No.
And imagine, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, when being really vocal about your feelings probably wasn't as accepted. A lot of grieving and grief must have been done very, very internally and privately, without any catharsis of, you know.
And unfairly. Yeah. Unfairly, when you're talking about, you know, I don't want to get into that, it's a topic for a discussion, but, you know, when you talked about people taking their own lives or whatever, which is, to me, the saddest thing. you know, that again, you're caught in a moment and can't get out of it. But you couldn't talk about that years ago. You couldn't talk about people that had chosen to end their life that way. Now I come from a totally different angle and say it's all about, you know, opening up and talking and being honest with your feelings and saying, yeah, I've had a tough time. And, you know, I'm finding it hard to get through this. Mm. But be able to go to friends or be able to go to people and loved ones and say. Mm. Because I grew up in a generation where you couldn't say that. And and that's even goes back to sitting down and telling my dad, hey, Dad, you know, I love you and you've made such a difference in my life. And that's what I wanted to say, but it wasn't that generation.
Yeah. It's harder to do it.
Because I remember the loving thing. Once you realise your parents love in different ways, and I remember even when I wrote my book and I talked about my own mental health, and I remember watching TV one night and he just put his hands on his shoulder and looked at me and a tear in his eyes. He said, I wish I could have helped more, son. And to me, that was more loving than because I knew that was a huge thing for him to say. Mm. You know, he was a macho guy, and he just he got it.
Mm. Can I ask you about the anxiety? And we're talking about expressing how we feel as adults, especially if we feel anxious or we're feeling that sort of the fear of grief and all that new fear it brings that you mightn't have experienced before. Anxiety in kids and how that manifests itself and their inability to communicate why they have that pain in their tummy or why they react.
It's difficult,
the way they do.
And it's a very difficult issue. It's a very difficult issue of about how children deal with grief or what, as parents, they should do or advise. It's really, I suppose, in a situation is really. My advice in that sense is for people not to be so scared to go and see a therapist, to go through and see that their children are, I suppose, going through grief stages in the right way. Because it's very hard to know with children. Like, I don't have children myself, but, you know, they're at an age where they would bottle things up. Mm. People I know are talking about things, mental health and all that, you know, but we're only still scratching the surface. Mm. You know, I mean, when I go out and talk to men especially, I say, look, okay, let's lose the BS here. Do you still have a problem talking to your wife or your kids or things about issues in your life? And 80% of them put up their hand and say, yes, we still have a problem, because it's deemed to be a show of weakness. And children, they don't have that weakness in a sense, but they can also grieve years later about things that, you know, you think... You know, I get a lot of parents would come to me and say, you know, but this happened 10 years ago. They lost their granddad or something like that. But now they're only grieving now. Mm. So it's a very tough and difficult area, because, you know, I've seen that grief around schools or whatever. I mean, we're now going through this, you know, horrible situation now with these three young children. Yeah. And that brings up grief for anybody concerned in that. You know, there'll be children going and saying, look, I just don't understand, Mum, they just don't understand. Yeah. So that's a very thin, look, it's just reaching out for help at that situation, that knowing that it's, the best advice I can give is really just the same, but applies to anybody with mental health, that, you know, it's okay not to feel okay. We all don't feel okay. We all don't have perfect lives at any age, but, you know, that really you need to seek help, and you need to have the courage and bravery, I suppose, and the skills to say, look, I need help through this. And as parents, they need to be able to say, look, I need professional help to know that my child is dealing with grief, if the loss of a father through a terminal illness or a mother through an illness, or somebody has taken their lives, or even an accident or whatever like that. You know, you look at.
I think it also creates, I think, for the future as well, a sort of normalcy for them. I mean, my youngest son has severe anxiety at the moment, and he actually turned around a couple of months ago and said, oh, my favourite song is You Got a Friend in Me from Toy Story.
Lovely.
And I was like, why? And he said, because there's a line that says, you've got your troubles and I got mine. And he's
Isn't
seven.
That lovely?
And I just went...
Isn't
okay,
that lovely?
We're getting somewhere.
Absolutely.
Now to be able to identify that.
Yeah.
That's
but
really.
That is so powerful.
Yeah.
And I just sent a song. I always listen to a song called Always Tomorrow by Gloria Estefan years ago. Yeah. Because the line, people resonate with lines and things that keep them going. And for me, it's, you know, I'm going to be better, and there's always tomorrow. And I sent it to a friend of mine that's struggling in the States, and she just came back. She said, oh my God, I listened to that song. She said, I cried because she said, I realized that there's going to be a better day for me tomorrow. And music with young people or those sorts of things is so powerful that they can take that one line.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast. I don't know if you know Brené Brown at
all. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I've only just gotten into her, right? But I'm like,
I know,
knee deep now. Yeah. She was on the Dax Shepard podcast, and he was saying the one thing he's taught himself to get through his anxiety is, this is temporary.
Yeah,
this is
absolutely.
That's like his Keep mantra. And it was just so simple, and it totally makes sense. But ever since I heard it,
absolutely,
I feel so empowered when I'm in situations. Or, go, this is temporary. Whatever's happening right this day, this minute. It's amazing how sometimes small...
And I say to people, it's only thoughts.
Yeah.
And people look at me and I say, it's only thoughts. Yeah. You know, that's all it is. I mean, be anxious about something that's actually happened. But most anxiety is driven of the thought of what's going to happen, or the thought of regrets or the things like that. But they're only thoughts, and we can reframe them. We can change them, because you can look at different ways of your life, and you can look at it, say, okay, what I have to do, for instance, if I am an anxious, the first thing I do, apart from getting the breathing and the sort of meditation, that is, I write down what it is that I'm really worried about. And then I write down beside it, what's the worst that can happen? What, you lose your job? Isn't there a chance you get another one? You know, you break up a relationship. Isn't there a chance you'll find someone else to love? You know, all these things. And when you peer it back like that and say, really, you know, where are the facts behind it? That everybody thinks you're this type of person. No, that's not the facts at all.
No, I even remember thinking, I used to do that as well, and write down, you go to jail or you get fired. But even then, this year, I spent some time in a prison doing a podcast. And even I was actually like really surprised at how much hope there was in the prison.
Absolutely.
So even if you ended up in that situation, which is the worst possible situation, there's actually hope living in there as well, which is so
enlightening. Of course, because they say, look, I've got through this.
Yeah.
I can get through this.
Yeah.
And I can be a better person at the end of it.
Even if I have to be there forever.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's always hope. I mean, even when you talk to people, and I've dealt with a lot of people through my talks and that sort of environment, also people that maybe have terminal diseases and stuff like that. And at a stage, they come to the thing as, okay, you know, it's a case of making the best of your life. You know, it's a case of, you know, there'll be hope. They'll say, look, you know, it's given me hope to do things that I never thought I'd do, to travel the world, to go hang gliding, whatever it is. There's hope out there. And I keep saying that to people. I keep saying that, you know, again, going back to that U2 song, for most people there that are in that situation where they're having morbid thoughts or whatever, they're just stuck in a moment. They're stuck in a moment. They feel trapped, whether that's 5 minutes, 5 weeks, 5 years. They just feel that this can't go on. I can't live another day without my wife. I can't, you know, I can't go back to my partner and tell them I've lost my job. I can't. But if they just reframe it for that moment and saying, is this the worst thing? And if you can get through that, then you can get through anything. So it is a matter of just simply saying, this is temporary. These are only thoughts. You know, these are not facts. They're not, you know, and reframe it. And people can learn all those types of skills to get over anxiety, because anxiety is just a thought pattern. It's coming from a fight and flight, you know, get worried about this. It hasn't even happened, you know.
Thank you so much for joining us. I think even that last bit there is really so helpful for people. And thank you for sharing a story of your dad.
Oh, no, thank you.
I wish I got to meet him. He sounds like a really great guy. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.